This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 154. Today we speak with Anthony Bradley about his book, Liberating Black Theology.
Welcome to Christ the Center. We have a very special episode today for you. Let me first introduce the panelists. We have here in the studio Jonathan Brack, who is admissions counselor at Westminster Theological Seminary. How are you doing, Jonathan?
It's good to be here, and I'm doing well.
Good. And we also have Saran Brown, who is a graduate of Westminster and is currently attending Emmanuel Chapel, OPC Church, down in Philadelphia. It's great to have you on the program, Saran.
Good to be here, Jared.
Contributing a little bit. He has read the book that we're going to talk about. My name is Jared Oliphant. I'm Director of Admissions at Westminster Theological Seminary. And our guest today, I'm thrilled to have on. He's a very busy guy, so we really appreciate him taking the time to talk with us. We have Anthony Bradley, who is, let me get all the stats right, he's Associate Professor of Theology and Ethics at King's College in New York, New York. How are you doing, Anthony?
I'm doing well.
Good. Well, this episode is really going to touch on a number of things. I want especially to talk about the book that you have out that is called Liberating Black Theology, The Bible and the Black Experience in America. And that's a revised form of, I think, your dissertation that you did here at Westminster, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And in it, I mean, I got into it really right when it came out just because I thought it was an interesting topic, but I had no idea the depth to which he goes to investigate both Reformed theology, kind of introducing that in the front part of the book, and then how that is contrasted with what you call Black theology and the developments with particularly a man by the name of James Cone. But I really want you to discuss it. And I guess my first question is, what prompted you to talk about the topic in the first place, both from your own biographical experience and you know, if you could explain what the book does with the topic.
Yeah, you know, I was raised in a very large United Methodist Church in Atlanta. And I was raised in a community of graduates of Morehouse and Spelman College and the Interdenominational Theological Center there at Morehouse. It was a very progressive, predominantly African-American church. We had one white guy who decided to stay after all the white people moved out when the blacks moved in the late 60s and in early 70s. And I was raised in a community of people that were very, very concerned about justice and the connection between the gospel and the liberation of African Americans, particularly in the U.S. and more directly in the South. So I was raised sitting on the laps of people who knew Martin King, Ralph Abernathy, who were participants in the civil rights movement. Wow. And so in my background and tradition, there was much a connection and synergy in church, speaking about issues of repentance and faith, but also speaking about issues of justice. And as I went through seminary, I began to have interest in revisiting my own background and history. So I started doing a series of independent studies while I was in seminary. And that basically led to an interest that I couldn't shake. So when I got to Westminster, it just sort of blossomed into my dissertation, and it continues to be a topic that I'm interested in today.
Yeah, and wondering if you could just, you don't have to go through every chapter, but just kind of summarizing what, if you could define for someone who maybe doesn't come from the same context and who is wondering, okay, what is going on with Black theology? How is it defined? How is it distinct? How would you describe it?
It's basically a theology that emerged in the late 1960s to address a question that no one was really answering, namely, what does the gospel have to say What does Christianity have to say? What's the church's role in addressing the issues of social injustice that is a part of the black experience in America? It emerged in the absence of a conversation that was happening in Protestantism, and its chief architect, James Cone, was actually in his PhD studies in the Chicago area and was wondering why it is that theologians were talking about the transcendence of God and Moltmann and Boltmann, but no one, and Paul Tillich, et cetera, called Bart, but no one was really addressing the issues that were happening on the streets in the south side of Chicago in terms of people experiencing racial injustice. Mm-hmm. So it really emerged out of a context of saying, hey, we need something to address this issue. And it basically comes down to this. It recognizes that God is concerned about the poor and the oppressed. It takes very literally, and some would argue literalistically, the words of Jesus in the Gospels regarding the poor, and applies those to the black experience, and essentially reduces the gospel to this, that God is God of the poor and the oppressed, and those who are poor and oppressed in America are black people, and mm-hmm. the oppressor, those who are oppressing blacks, are white. And so God sent his son, Jesus Christ, to liberate African Americans from the racial and social injustices of white people, the white establishment, and particularly to liberate them so they can be free to be the kinds of people that God created black people to be. And so the book is really intended to explain some of this history and background, and really to sort of land this discussion recognizing two things. One, that the Bible most definitely addresses issues of structural and social injustice mm-hmm. because the fall mm-hmm. really did happen. And so, you know, it's throughout the entire biblical narrative that God cares about the context in which people live. But it's also true that the Bible calls people to personal faith and repentance in Christ yeah. and to commit their lives to following him. And sadly, that second piece is what was left behind in the sort of political theology that developed throughout the 1970s. So my argument is we need to hold these things in tension, recognizing that the God of righteousness is concerned about righteousness in social structures, but he's also concerned about righteousness within the hearts of people, individual people who have moral culpability and responsibility, and they have moral dispositions with respect to God, the entire Trinity, that need to be reconciled and dealt with. So let's not just do one thing, mm-hmm. sort of focus on the structural issues, because that tends to land you back into political theology. But we also don't want to be sort of navel-gazing isolationists and only think about these issues of personal repentance, because then we leave behind the fact that the fall affect, you know, personal lives, but also the ways in which personal sin affects social structure. So we need to do both and, not either or.
Yeah, that's right. There's definitely kind of an exclusivist tone to the theology. I also want to ask, you know, that I do want people to read the book, and I don't want to just kind of, you know, reproduce the book. I want to get your thoughts on a lot more broader issues. One question that I had actually about just black theology in general was, obviously they had thought about how this relates to not just America, but, you know, the world at large and other forms of oppression, or at least I would hope that he would get that question at some point and address it. How does this relate to other forms of oppression, even with other races and in other contexts? Or did you see that even addressed as you were looking at the topic?
Yeah, you know, it came out of the late 1960s and early 70s is when it really began. And so on the radar of black pastors and theologians at seminaries in the Protestant world at the time was really just the black experience. Mm-hmm. It was a few years later that it expanded into the South African experience. And so as issues of apartheid began to emerge and entered into the radar of these theologians, what you began to get by the late 70s, early 80s was more synergy between African liberation theology, which has some sort of Dutch reform connections in that narrative, but also the sort of black experience here in the States. There was a Latin American line that was mainly predominantly Roman Catholic, and that started from a different place. What black liberation theology has in common with Latin liberation theology, which was really developed more by Gustavo Gutierrez and Benigno, et cetera, is that both Cohn and those guys read Rauschenbusch separately, and the social gospel movement was the catalyst for helping them, in their own understanding, rearticulate some of the emphasis of Christianity.
Yeah.
It's now sort of evolved and expanded into any subgroup that sees itself as oppressed, mainly oppressed by sort of white-dominated, male-dominated structural systems. So there is feminist liberation theology. There's gay, lesbian liberation theology. There's Asian liberation theology. Within the feminist camp, there's a split because the black feminists think the white feminists are racist.
Wow.
So there's womanist theology, which is distinct from feminist theology because the black women and the white women don't get along. And so any group, any subculture that sees itself as oppressed, is a new candidate for having its own liberation motif.
Wow, that's amazing. Saran, I think you had a question.
Yes, Dr. Bradley, first of all, I want to thank you for writing the book. I was definitely inspired by it. I'd like to also congratulate you on a job well done, especially for the apologetical methodology that was employed in his book. A few weeks ago, I read an article by Scott Oliphant on the irrationality of sin, and in that article, he praises Paul for his apologetical approach in Acts 17, and I definitely see the same apologetical approach in his book. You definitely show the internal inconsistencies of James Cohn, and that as a result, you bring forth a theology proper, I should say. But my first question for you is, again, my last year at Westminster, I did a paper in James Cone's Black Theology, my modern age class with Jeff Jew. And one thing I noticed, one of the major turnoffs initially was that the three ideological permutations that served as his prolegomena to the systematic theology is Black Power Movement, Civil Rights Movement, and I forget the third. But however, you know, he doesn't take in consideration the black experience of slavery, which I find is odd because, again, one thing he is consistent about in his theology is the theology of victim, being that of a victim. And again, I think it's odd that he doesn't bring in the issue of slavery and conducted his theology. But how much of a difference do you think his theology will look if he had took that under consideration?
Well, I think for Cohn, he was really more concerned about his immediate conversation. I mean, this is a man who was raised in Arkansas. He grew up under Jim Crow, and saw the horrors of sort of white systemic white injustice in his small town in Arkansas, sort of raised in the African Methodist Episcopal tradition. And so what was really on his radar was specifically the experience in America. And it was really later on that he began to sort of give a nod to the narrative that we receive from slavery. And my guess is that at least in his context, what slavery done was simply, I think as it did in some of his later writings, just give him more ammunition to say that the white approach, what he calls the white approach, or simply white theology, or the white church, or white Christians, are simply incapable of treating blacks with dignity. I mean, I think what's important about the slavery tradition is that that what he does not acknowledge is, for example, those communities of African Americans who were free and who were also able in some aspects, in some parts of the country, to actually transcend and move beyond some of the social and structural injustices that were around them, and to really think about, you know, how it is that they made it, and to think more clearly about what difference it would make, what difference it made in those who made it, who were able to sort of make something of their lives, and those who did not. But the slavery question was simply not his main burden.
It was not radical enough for him.
Well, it was not immediate enough. I mean, it was really far removed from his frame of reference. You know, in the late 1960s and early 70s, there was stuff still happening, right? I mean, you still had a lot of riots out in L.A. I mean, you still had stuff happening in Detroit. You still had all sorts of things in Chicago. I mean, there were still things happening on the ground, on the street. There were still protests at Southern universities all over the Southeast. I mean, there was still activity. So it wasn't until things settled down in the Black experience that a lot of the Black theologians were able to sort of look at slavery. There's a guy named Alistair Key. He's a professor emeritus at Edinburgh. And he wrote a book called The Rise and Demise of Black Theology. And his main critique is that Black liberation theologians really have ignored some of the contact points with slavery, but particularly the social injustices that are currently happening in Africa among Africans. And that part of the narrative is actually undermining their own theology, because they can't make a case about oppression if they only selectively talk about, you know, their favorite oppressed people. And you can't simply call white people as a category the oppressed, when in fact you have blacks oppressing blacks here in the U.S. You have black Africans oppressing black Africans and all over the continent, and there's this silence on those issues.
Yeah. Well, you know, I also wanted to get to the ecclesiological questions, which I know you've written a lot about. For those who don't know, Anthony has a great blog out there. If you just if you Google the Institute Anthony Bradley, you'll come up with the URL for that, and we'll link to that in the show notes. But I really did want to ask you, you're in the PCA, and do you have any idea of what percentage there are of black elders in the PCA?
I don't know percentage wise. I know there's 38.
Okay. All right.
I know the number. I know that you could put us, I mean, you could put all the black TEs on two vans.
All right. Well, good. That helps. Well, I wanted to ask you specifically, can you talk a little bit about just the culpability for that small percentage? You don't have to stick with the PCA, but just, I guess, you know, Reformed churches at large, both on the part of the predominantly white Reformed churches and also on the part of black Christians out there. What's the balance that we should see ecclesiologically on both sides? And it also doesn't have to be relegated to black and white. You know, we can talk about Hispanic and Asian and whatever else. But what are your thoughts on that?
Could you clarify? You said the culpability with respect to what exactly?
Well, just with you know, the percentage of membership and involvement, and you know, the PCA I would describe as a predominantly white denomination. I think that's just a cold hard fact.
That would be accurate.
Yeah. So what can a white denomination do, and what can black Christians do to kind of meet in the middle to make sure that, or not make sure, but to at least make steps towards making that a more diverse denomination and Reformed churches at large?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. You know, this is a complicated narrative. I mean, there are so many layers to this question that actually I've argued in the past impede progress. simply, you know, at the first level is just simply geography. Reformed churches tend to be physically located in homogenous communities. And so some of this is just a consequence of location.
Yeah.
Most PCA churches that are in the suburbs are in communities where there are extremely low percentages of African Americans or Latinos. And so it's not necessarily that those churches are doing anything on purpose. It's just a consequence of where they're located, right?
Yeah.
And you can see that, for example, in the Philadelphia area, until recently, most of the PCA churches were in the counties, right? They were in Montgomery County, and they were in areas where high concentrations of African Americans are not. You also have the issue of a history within the Reformed tradition that really hasn't been, I would argue, kind of openly discussed and dealt with. There's been some attempts to sort of acknowledge some things in discussions about reconciliation, but there's real history, particularly in the PCA and the churches in the Southeast, that's recently come to light, and there are more things that are coming to light that simply need to be handled and dealt with and talked about. Until some of those things are talked about, I mean, if you're an African American trying to come into this community, I mean, you have a central question about whether or not this is really safe space. I mean, if this is a narrative that we haven't really discussed and talked about, if there hasn't been confession and repentance and real movement toward reconciliation based on disclosing parts of that story,
mm-hmm.
it's just a hard sell. It's just a hard sell. I would argue for a lot of African Americans. The other thing is that Reformed communities tend to be extremely arrogant in the sense that they just assume that everybody wants to be with them.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, we've got the confession, we've got great theologians, we've got Herman Bovink, we've got Calvin, and so, I mean, we've got the goods. Why aren't people interested? You know, why aren't people just flocking? You know, why isn't it that like Native Americans and Latinos and African Americans aren't sort of beating down the door saying, please let us in? Why is that the case? Well, because there's very vibrant Christianity within indigenous communities. I mean, it's very rare to go to any subdominant community in America, whether it be a black neighborhood or a Latino neighborhood, and not see churches everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, why would somebody, you know, want to leave a community of people that they have good relationships with, sort of move into the Reformed diaspora, and so some of these things are partly circumstantial. Some of them have a lot to do with the fact that there's issues that we still haven't really dealt with, that for minorities need to be dealt with. If you're in the dominant community, you know, it doesn't really affect you. But, you know, as I was coming in and coming through, and as I began to read about, you know, Jonathan Edwards being a slave owner, as I began to read about the Dutch Reformed tradition creating apartheid in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
as I began to read about, you know, some of the Curse of Ham theology, what I was looking for was someone who had dealt with that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was just tough to find something.
Yeah.
And that really raises questions about, well, have they stopped believing this?
Right.
Am I going to go somewhere and hear a weird sermon about the curse of Ham or the curse of Canaan? I mean, how come we still haven't talked about those things? So, I mean, you know, those are all pieces of the puzzle, I'd say.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Dr. Bradley, while we're on the topic of ecclesiology, let me ask you this one question. It should have been my first question. Who do you plan to target with this book? Like, what's the audience? And the reason why I ask that, because, again, growing up in an African-American church, I don't really see our congregations more geared towards doctrinal issues. They're more so focused on the preached word. So therefore, again, who do you plan on reaching with this book? Is it merely academic people, those who are in seminary, or who do you plan on reaching with the book?
That's a great question. My primary target for this book is anyone that has $18. that's the primary target. The secondary target is anyone that can log on to Amazon.com.
WTSbooks.com, you mean. Right.
Yeah, that's the second group.
Yeah.
Because it's a more academic a book. Our brother Brown, what I find is that those who tend to track with it well have some theological background. So my conversation partners are going to be pastors and theologians in the evangelical tradition, but also sort of those who have been theologically trained within the Black church tradition. So in conversation also. With Black pastors and Black theologians in that tradition. So basically, the sort of religion major, philosophy, theology major community on up is the target group that will probably most track with this particular book. I've got some more projects in the queue that I think would open out some contacts with the African American community in general, people on the pews. There's a community of us, me and Eric Mason, Anthony Carter. We got together and we have another book that's going to come out next January, addressing core issues in the Black community from a reform perspective, and that book is for folks on the pews.
That's very cool. I was just going to say, Eric Mason is a pastor in the Philadelphia area at Epiphany, so that works well.
Just a follow-up question on that. Do you see, this is from my experience, those Black pastors who receive more of a formal education, do you see them leaning more towards or being more sensitive towards a Black theology approach?
Well, I mean, what's really been interesting, Saran, is that the Black church in general has sort of rejected Black liberation theology as a system. And mainly because it's not very pastoral. So for example, if you get cancer, you're in the hospital, Black liberation theology is not going to help you deal with the fact that you have cancer. If your husband is beating on you, Black liberation theology isn't going to help you that much. When your kids end up on crack, end up in jail, there's not a lot that Black liberation theology can do. It's not very pastoral. That's the problem. That's its main problem among many. And so the Black church in general, hasn't really dealt with it. It's really interesting. It's kind of a funny story. When I wrote the book, this was during the time when Jeremiah Wright was speaking, Barack Obama was running for president back in 2008. And I mentioned to my mom that I was writing this book on Black liberation theology. And she sort of asked me, well, what is that? And what was really interesting is that I grew up in a church that preached it. we just had no idea that this is what it was. And it's basically tailed off in terms of pastors preaching it, sort of being in the pews in general. And I fundamentally believe that the political theology approach actually set the stage for the Black church being infected by the prosperity gospel movement.
Oh yeah, right.
When you have such a focus on politics and economics, and then you have real people's stories of pain and suffering, wrestling with the devil, being attacked by him, and needing something, needing a narrative to sort of deal with that. It just completely opened the door for health and wealth and quick fix theology to move in in a context where political theology just wasn't dealing with the questions that people had to deal with day to day.
Yeah, and just getting back to Saran's question, I can personally attest I was at Southern Evangelical Seminary has an apologetics conference every year, and Anthony was one of the main speakers this year. And regarding audience, he gave about an hour lecture, and most of it was just summarizing the book and also making this point on the gospel. And I have never seen a reaction like that from an audience in that context. I mean, he had to stop about five times because people were clapping and interrupting him. And at the end, he got a standing ovation, which was just absolutely awesome to see. And the reason I mention that is because these are some seminary students, but it's also just people in the regular churches and people who don't really come from a reform context by and large. It's an evangelical seminary, and their apologetic approach is completely different from us. So I'm not arguing for that, but I'm saying I think that the message that you're portraying, Anthony, in this book and with your work can reach a very broad audience and do so very effectively. I think you've proven that. So thank you. And I think Jonathan had a question as well.
Yeah, Dr. Bradley, the question I had in reference to what we've been talking about, ecclesiology and the black theology kind of progressing towards a health and wealth gospel, a question I have in mind is with Cone's theology and how black theology has progressed into more of a health and wealth gospel, what do you see, even at the very beginning, if there is one at all, as an eschatology of black theology? Is the goal, versus is the goal in sort of a victimology narrative that the eschaton will be ushered in as soon as everybody has justice in the world? Is it, would you characterize it as like a post-mill or a pre-mill understanding of eschatology, or could you comment a little bit to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, that's probably the one theological category that black liberation theologians just actually do not talk about is eschatology, which is really, really interesting. It seems though, however, that the goal is, this is really strange. It seemed like the goal is simply a transference of power, so that those who are subdominant become dominant now, and that the kingdom will be manifest in its glory when not when there's sort of racial and socioeconomic parity, but when subdominant groups are actually in the advantage position. I mean, that's sort of the actual stream that you get. It's really fascinating point to think about the eschatology, because if you read Walter Rauschenbusch's book on the social gospel, he says in that book that he's a premillennialist, which is really, really odd, because what I understand about premillennialism would not lend itself to a social gospel conclusion.
Right, sounds inconsistent.
Right, right. So I wonder if, and this is just a question that I have that maybe somebody at Westminster can do as a THM thesis. And I'm not throwing any kind of hints to Brother Brown.
There you go.
But the eschatological question really needs to be addressed, because I'm not really sure how Cone and others really articulate and understand the sort of eschatological positions that we know. I wonder if they have their own eschatological framework and what that looks like based on Rauschenbusch's own confession of himself being a premillennialist. That's just a really, really, really good question, and is a really, really open question. It sort of reminds me also that you know, as we think about black pastors today, I would say that James Cone is probably less influential than Cornel West, and Cornel West, you know, he started out in the black liberation tradition. He's much more of a philosopher, and I would say that if you want to think about, you know, religious scholars who are influencing black pastors today, I would turn more to Cornel West than I would James Cone. Yeah.
Hmm. He's somewhat of a celebrity now, isn't he? Cornel West, intellectual celebrity in the black
community. He is. I mean, he's the most famous, you know, well-known black public intellectual that we have. He and Robbie George at Princeton have a really fantastic conversation about what it means to be a Christian. That folks can Google. It's just really, really interesting stuff. And what's interesting is, you know, Cornel West is shifting. He's sounding a little more evangelical than he was 10 years ago. And it's just really interesting as he's sort of seen some of the weaknesses in the more socialized Marxist approach out of theology, that he's beginning to articulate some things. We're waiting on him to come down. He's very close to saying that he's against abortion. So we're kind of waiting that out.
Okay. Interesting. Thanks for coming on that. Yeah, and just a follow up comment on what you said about the eschatology.
Yeah,
it sounds interesting because sort of stereotypically, at least in my mind, I think that a typical black pastor in an urban area has a goal to sort of transform the community, right? And so you see a sort of that somewhat lends itself to, if it does have an eschatology, it's sort of post-mill. Like the more and more we transform the community, we redeem the community, and that community will be a part of the eschaton.
It may be transformational eschatology, but not in those terms.
Right. Yeah. Just not articulated the same way.
No, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And I would say that if, and this is an all caps if, okay, if Reformed communities, seminarians and theologians were had any sorts of inkling toward being provocative and creative and innovative, they would actually not lead off discussions about Reformed theology with the solas. Uh-huh. They would actually lead off with the eschatology. If you want to bring black folks into covenant theology, it's actually the eschatology.
That is such
probably,
a good point.
Much more palatable at first.
Yeah.
That the eschatology leads back to the solas.
Yeah.
And I think what's happened is that folks sort of lead off with the solas and end up talking about predestination. Yeah. And that's just too much.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right.
Like, that is too much of a category jump. I'm like, listen, Calvin got to this way back in chapter 4. We can wait on this one.
I
okay?
know. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why don't we lead off speaking about the things, talking about a point of contact. I mean, why don't we lead off with the sorts of things that we actually have in common, eschatologically, especially if you're from the Dutch Reformed tradition, with respect to transforming culture, renewing culture, redeeming culture. I mean, all those sorts of things resonate.
Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, that's what I do when I'm in all black context. I just sound like Kuiper and Bovink. I mean, that's all I do. And black folks love it. I was recently preaching at my home church, this all black United Methodist Church. And I just gave a very post-mill leaning a sermon on Isaiah 61, and I got standing ovations, and people came up, for the altar call. I mean, I'm like, why aren't we doing this? When you're trying to reach communities, you need to be a little more creative in terms of how you do it. It's not the solas. That's the first point of contact with folks. I'm like, why are we talking about that? That eschatology, like covenant theology, those are the sorts of narratives that historically have always been in the black church experience.
Always. Yeah. And, when we were at the conference, we got a chance to catch up a little bit. I think we both resonate with that same message that it seems like the, Reformed these days is just wholly identified with, I'm a card-carrying five-pointer, And so I can just call myself, you know, fully Reformed. And look, that's part of the Reformed tradition, and I think we both recognize that. But it seems to be like, you know, a lot of people in this, you know, neo-Calvinism type of a strand that's going on see that as, you know, just the end all to Reformed theology. When you're, I think you're exactly right. Eschatology is what drives a lot of it. And, you know, all those things like predestination can be in the background of maybe what you're thinking. But I think what you want to emphasize is how do you communicate this whole history of Reformed theology in all its nuances to people who, you know, may not be familiar with the terms. And so you're right. You know, as Van Til says, you have to choose the right point of contact. And so anyway, I applaud you for that.
Yeah, and you know, the first book I would give, I mean, I wouldn't hand somebody a confession. I mean, that's just silly, right?
Yeah.
The Wisdom of the Confession or the Belgic. I mean, I would hand somebody a copy of Bill Egger's book, Truth in All Its Glory. That would be the first book, right?
Yeah.
That's an introduction to Reformed theology. I mean, that would be the book that I would distribute if I'm seeking to sort of encourage people to think in new categories and new terms theologically. I would give them a copy of Creation Regained by Al Walters. Again, to sort of think about more broadly the implications of the gospel and the work of the triune God with respect to making his world, you know, what God intended it to be. To me, that's just far more palatable and inviting than the sort of adversarial approach that you get at the outset with the solas, right? Mm. Because what happens is, and this is a concern for a lot of for some of us in the sort of Black Reform community, that you get these cats who are new to Reform theology, and the first thing they start doing is attacking the Black Church,
right?
Well, if you start attacking the Black Church, I mean, how winsome and inviting is that? Why would you do that? It doesn't make any sense. It would seem like you would seek to sort of build and construct a narrative that would have people ask new questions and then consider the possibility that there is much more to Christianity than the doctrine of salvation.
Yeah,
Dr. Bradley, I want to go back again on the question with ecclesiology and the Black theology. Basically, you're saying, from what I was getting, is that Black theology's failure is that it's not practical. It's not practical at all. And that's where I guess we could say that the health and wealth gospel succeeds in our community because it addresses social and economic issues. However, and I want to word this question carefully, because I want to go back to the slave theology. One thing we see different, I see a shift within a Black church theologically between, of course, the slave era and the modern era. Of course, the modern era falling victim to this health and wealth gospel, which is a very sensitive topic for me because, I told you I grew up in a Baptist church, and I actually saw a good sound Baptist church fall victim to this particular teaching, this particular gospel. So, again, this is a very sensitive issue with me. But when you see, for I could say slave theology or the slave era is like the highest level of victimology in a Black experience. No one would disagree with that. However, it didn't affect their theology in a negative sense. It didn't affect their theology or it didn't produce a false theology. In fact, it produced a theology that's really consistent with the history of the church. It is a theology of suffering unto exaltation. It's a theology that is eschatological.
Right.
I see a difference. You know, again, I see a difference within, again, it's the slave period, whereas, again, we suffer more so socially and economically than we are now. But yet we're affected. Our theology is affected in a negative way now. I mean, you know, through the wealth gospel.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Saran, that's a fantastic point. I think you nailed a very fundamental distinction that, you know, a slave theology was primarily otherworldly. And because of that, it tended to focus on Jesus coming back and making things right. It was focused on getting the heck out of here. Right. I'm on a train. Right.
Yeah.
I'm on my gospel train, mm-hmm. Because what happened is there was very little hope that things right now were going to change. So we need to focus. Talk about keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus. We need to focus on what's next. And I think what happened as a consequence of the civil rights movement is that people really began to focus. What happened is that people got introduced to the fact that, I mean, yeah, we need to get out of here, but, you know, there's some nice stuff here too, right? I mean, yeah, heaven's good, but I can get a Lexus, right?
Right, exactly.
Let's shoot for it.
I mean, they're going to be some streets paved with gold, right? But mm-hmm. I can get me some Gucci shoes right now.
Right now, exactly.
right now, okay? And if I name it, I can get it tomorrow, right?
Yep.
And I think one of the consequences of that otherworldly theology is that it became a bit Gnostic in the sense that the material world today, right here, right now, really. And this was in part because of the structural injustice that there was no sense that the material world could actually bring us any joy, any fulfillment. That there really wasn't anything good, and so that once those strictures were removed, what you had is this new appreciation of imminence and the here and the right now. The Africans talk about, you know, foot on the ground theology.
Yeah.
And it was one of the unintended consequences, you know, rather than one of the negative externalities of people being able, you know, for the first time in the community's history, to actually have access to material things that have been withheld in previous generations. And what happened, I would argue, is that there wasn't enough prophetic preaching against the idolatry of stuff. That to me continued to introduce and set the stage for the fact that, to set the stage for the prosperity gospel was not enough warnings about the corruptibility and the idolatry that comes when you begin to have access to stuff.
Yeah.
Because stuff has a way of creating a feedback loop where you want more of it. It tickles your idols. It tickles those things that make you feel like you have a sense that life is nice and good and settled, that everything's working out, that I don't have any pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. And that tension, I would say, wasn't negotiated well because there was too much focus on these political things. And there was this odd introduction of dessert. I deserve to have a big house.
Yeah, yeah.
I deserve to have a car, a promotion, because it's been withheld from my community. But again, there wasn't enough prophetic warnings against some of the negative ways that affects our spirituality.
Yeah, and I also want to bring up Dr. Jeff Ju. He did a lecture at the T4G, Together for the Gospel conference, in, I think it was April. But he was talking about the issue of diversity in the church. And what he pointed out was diversity can look a lot of different ways. There can be, obviously, maybe, you know, a church that has one race predominantly, or whether that be black, white, Asian, whatever. But there's also, you know, churches who just have one economic stratum, you know, in it. So, you know, a wealthy church or a poor church. And he kind of seemed to indicate that sometimes those actually look more the same than the single race churches. So it's more complicated than just having one church that has, you know, a lot of different races in it. Because if they're all, you know, very wealthy, then, you know, that even can look the same. And all that is to say that I think that it opens up the question of a diverse church to not just racially, even though that's definitely a part of it, but socioeconomic factors as well that play into that. Do you deal with that as you start looking at these kinds of questions of, you know, if you were kind of the general of diversity in the church and could, you know, position people and have a wish list of what you would want to see in the church at large, how much is the socioeconomic factor in your discussions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if I was Archbishop, right?
Yeah, right.
Um, Well, you know, I'm a proponent of churches looking like their neighborhoods. And I think that the automobile has really complicated this entire question, because the automobile allows us to commune with people by affinity.
Yeah.
And not by geography. I tell for years I've been telling the very, very, very same story about an OPC church down on 9th and around 9th and South.
Nathan Reed?
The Cummings.
Yes, Maywell Chapel.
Oh, that's
my
it?
Church. That's my church.
Okay,
yes.
Sure. Okay, yeah, okay. All right. That's been my poster boy church for a good decade. As an example of a church that is diverse but not on purpose, and it's diverse because it's a neighborhood church.
Yes.
And when I was there, I visited there several times when I was a student at Westminster. What I saw was the beauty of what happens when a church loves a local community. And within a congregation, you had people that had teeth and people that don't have teeth. Mm-hmm. You have people who graduated from college and people that clean the college. Mm-hmm. You had intact families and broken families. Okay. And you had not really, I mean, people weren't there because it was a banner of, hey, we are the world. People weren't there because the pastor was slick and cool and had an untucked shirt and was really, really slick. The people weren't there because the music was fantastic. People were there because the leadership loved the community, right? They just loved the neighborhood. And you know, what I find is that because we live in segregated communities, our churches reflect the neighborhood. And so I don't have any expectation that a church in a suburban community where it's 95% white is going to be diverse. It's kind of ridiculous to think that. And so to me, the question for me is not so much diversity on Sunday, but how are we sort of working toward diversity in the rest of our lives, Monday through Saturday? Because what happens on Sunday is a consequence of how we live the rest of the week. It doesn't work the other way around.
Wow, yeah.
So I'm much more interested in us living in more diverse neighborhoods so that local churches look like local neighborhoods. And to me, that's probably the best way to achieve the sorts of kingdom-oriented diversity that we think about, because the automobile and interstates just radically change people's incentives so that they aren't really forced to love people that they live near because they don't have to.
Yeah.
Well, that was awesome, Dr. Bradley. I have to ask you this one question. What do you think, or can you shed light, going back to James Cone, on his view of the image of God? And I don't have the book is actually right in front of me, so I can't really quote the exact page number. But I think that you say that the image of God is articulated in James Cone's theology is that of a victim. Man being the image of God is a... can you shed light on that? I don't know if I guess I don't have the book right in front of me, so I can't.
It's important to really think about it this way. It's the image. It's the image of Christ Christ, and this is, you mean this is straight out of, this is like straight Jeremiah Wright. Okay, yeah. Christ was a victim. Christ was a victim of social injustice and racial oppression, And so in order to identify fully with Christ, you have to see yourself as a victim of social and or racial oppression. And what happens is that becomes the image of God that God has come to redeem. That God has come to restore. He's come to restore through the work and person of Christ his oppressed image. As it exists in political and social space, and of course, I mean, if that is the presupposition of your identity, that you have to see yourself as a victim, then what happens is that you will do nothing but interpret your entire life through that lens.
Right.
That you will see all of your engagements in society and culture and church and your family, your marriage, as you being a victim of external oppression, and it'll completely distract you of your own culpability and sin and making contributions to the oppression of others, right?
Yeah, that's the problem practically, right? That's the one of the right. practical theological problems. What about systematically speaking? Does he view Adam as being created as victim? That's what I was trying to get at. Do you see that in his theology? Because that's one thing I got from your book is that he viewed Adam as being created as victim.
He wouldn't articulate it. Adam created as victim, sort of qua victim. Like that wouldn't be a category for him. However, at the end of the day, he would most certainly re-understand Adam as a victim of evil, and having been oppressed by evil, and that evil has different shades and colors, but its main color is white. But Adam, of course, is most certainly a victim of evil. And so as human beings, what God has come to liberate us from and free us from is the oppression of evil. Now, to some extent, I can agree with Cohn on that. But our point of departure is defining what that evil is. I mean, that really is the problem. The other problem, of course, is to only see human beings as victims of evil and not see them as anything else. And I would say that it's a very limited and atrophied theology, because it limits the Imago Dei to those negotiations of and understandings of what happened primarily at the fall, and doesn't really – what you do not find in Black liberation theology is an understanding of the human person before the fall. It's limited to a post fall interpretation of the human experience.
Yes, yeah, so there's no state of innocency with the Black theology per se.
Yeah, there's no understanding of what human beings are like before the fall, and how does that necessarily speak to how we think about what people need Jesus for, what people need the triune God for, what people need the church for, what people need community for and society for. That anthropological point is second stage. And so my argument in the book is that we need to go back to Genesis 1 and 2 and allow that to help us redefine what injustice is. Mm-hmm. Allow that to redefine what sin is, so that we can arrive at the sorts of remedies for those things in ways that bring dignity to the human person, bring glory to God, and direct us to the eschatological ends that were inaugurated by the coming of Christ himself.
Yeah.
Right. We need to go back so we can move forward.
Well, I also want to mention, Anthony has, some great articles, for World Magazine, online. You can also do a Google search, and maybe we can put a couple in the show notes as well. But given that, I mean, the book, your blog, your writing for World Magazine, and particularly this conversation has helped frame a ton of things for me, but I wanted to ask you just kind of as a conclusion, as you look out on the landscape of pastors in Reformed churches, and even, you know, in this context with Reformed students studying to eventually become pastors, what kind of, you know, based on the current conversation that we're having, what would you want to tell pastors going out there, either currently or people training to do that? What's the message that you think, coming from your perspective, you want to communicate?
Oh wow, that's a big question. Well, you know, I mean, you know, for me, my burden is to focus on the fact that no theological community has an untainted history. and that we were given, you know, in the Reformed tradition, we were given a theology that's embedded in a narrative. And what we need to be is more brutally honest about the fact that we actually haven't answered all the questions. That the system isn't there's some blind spots, there's some loopholes. There's more work to be done. That we weren't delivered, we were delivered a great system. We weren't delivered a perfect system. Because this system involves people that have flaws in terms of how they think and apply. That's the only reason you can have a Reformed tradition be proponents of the curse of Ham, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to really be, to sort of preach and teach with humility, recognizing that our theology must be reconciled with the biblical text. It must be reconciled with the story. And that the tradition must be reconciled with the Bible. And where the tradition fails with respect to what the Bible teaches, it's actually okay to admit that, because that does not undermine the system.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It actually validates the system, because the system is intended to elevate Scripture over the noetic effects of sin of the people in the church. And so we look forward to the Bible calling us out, calling out our idols, calling out our inconsistencies. We look forward to the Scriptures shedding light on the tradition, so that we don't repeat the same things that we did in the past, that we move forward and bring more glory and honor to Christ and his kingdom by rightly interpreting and applying what the biblical text actually says.
Yeah, wow.
Well said.
Well, you know, I want to thank you really for coming on and spending some time with us and, you know, dealing with something that, at least in my experience, hasn't been dealt with, I think, to the fullest extent. And I want to applaud you for really making that at least part of your cause out there. What's the URL for your blog that you write on?
It is something that I can't remember, actually.
we'll stick with the Google system then. If you Google Anthony Bradley and the Institute, that'll come up.
Yeah. Just Google my name. It'll come up.
There you go.
Yeah. which is kind of unfortunate. Like I'm too easily found. But you can Google my name. The Institute will come up. It's also linked on World Magazine's site.
Good.
As well.
Good. And also want to ask anything that's coming up in terms of speaking engagement or writings that are coming out in the relatively near future.
Yeah. Actually, I do have, I forgot I have a website. I have a website, dranthonybradley.com. And on that website, dranthonybradley.com, you can get links to my stuff at World Magazine, the ACT Institute, my blog, my Twitter feed is on there, and a list of upcoming speaking engagements. What's on the queue for me is speaking at the Coalition for Christian Outreach in February. I'll be actually at Perimeter Church in Atlanta in December. I'll be in Grand Rapids in January. And I'm looking forward to speaking to a group of budding entrepreneurs in Phoenix at the Marketplace One Institute in June. So I've got a few things on the horizon.
Very cool. Awesome. We'll definitely look out for that. And, of course, you can find Westminster at a few locations, wts.edu, facebook.com/Westminster Online. YouTube.com/Westminster Online. And of course, you can find Reform at reformforum.org, and send your emails and your thoughts to mail@reformforum.org. And thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Christ the Center.